First case for argument, United States v. Drew Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Copey.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Counsel.
My name is Abe Copey. I am here to represent the appellant, Drew Clark. We're asking that this Court reverse counts 2 through 5 because the government failed to adduce sufficient evidence in this case that the vehicle thefts fell within the narrow scope of the federal carjacking statute. I will turn first to counts 2 through 3, which deal with the Dodge Ram pickup truck that was taken from the Bootsy facility. We believe the Court should reverse those convictions because even looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, the government's Exhibit 6C plainly documents a nonviolent taking of that pickup truck. It was unoccupied at the time. The keys were left in the vehicle as well.
The statute doesn't say taking from a person.
From the presence of another.
For a presence.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
So what, I didn't see any presence cases cited. That is, carjacking prosecutions when the car was on an auto dealer's lot or otherwise a company's premises. Can you give me a case you would be relying on in that regard?
Your Honor, I don't believe we're challenging the presence requirement in this case. We're challenging the use of force. We believe that even though...
Can you answer the question? Do you have any presence cases, carjacking from company premises, where there are people guarding the premises, but not otherwise part of... You know, they're not like drivers.
Your Honor, I don't believe we cited any case in our brief to that effect.
Have you found any?
No, Your Honor, I have not. I'm sorry. That being said, though, I think the force requirement element is what we are saying that the government did not produce sufficient evidence of. Because again, at the time Mr. Clark got into the vehicle and began to drive it away, there was no evidence that he used any force to accomplish that taking.
He used premises force before he left the premises.
Before he left the Bootsy facility, there was evidence that he brandished a firearm. That is correct, Your Honor. Our argument is that the taking was already complete at the time he was in the vehicle by himself and he began to drive it away.
It wasn't as a practical matter. You could say that he had possession or control momentarily, but he hadn't completed the taking.
Your Honor, I believe actually this court's case law in Petruk, as well as the other cases cited by the government.
I know Petruk very well, and it is totally distinguishable from this case. That was a second taking case. This is arguably that, but it's more.
Well, then, Your Honor, I would also point the court to the Holloway decision by the Supreme Court, which said that we're really supposed to look at the precise moment that the taking occurs. So they actually, and I know Your Honor was on the panel in Petruk, endorsed that view that taking is a very narrow element and that taking has to be completed before carrying away can begin. That was true at common law. It's embodied in the federal carjacking statute.
That wasn't an issue in Petruk. I mean, I didn't write it, but the focus was on what happened 10 or 15 minutes later in a totally different environment. When the owner, who had been deprived, caught up with the perp, so to speak.
Yes, Your Honor. And the court found that in that instance, that was using force to retain possession of the vehicle. We would argue the same is true here. When Mr. Clark encountered DB, he did use a firearm.
So what's the standard review on that?
We take the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, Your Honor.
Isn't it clear error?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe
taking is not a question of fact.
No, Your Honor, because I think there is a legal definition that has to be met for this court to review de novo. Obviously, again, when we're doing sufficiency, we look at it in the light most favorable to the verdict.
Is the jury tied to the Oklahoma statutory definition of taking?
No, Your Honor, but I think it's...
Were the Holloway instructions given here?
There was a... instruction, I believe, very similar to what was approved in Holloway as well as in the Wright case.
Why is this case not like Wright? It seems like it's very... Wright seems to be very close to what we have here.
Where I think they're distinguishable, Your Honor, is, and this court clarified in Petruk, that Wright stands for the proposition that when force court coincides with the taking, so in other words, the way I read Wright is that the tie goes to the government, where it's impossible to really demark where the taking occurred and when the force began, then that is sufficient evidence. But here...
But in Wright, as I understand it, the thief had already gotten in the car. He had taken possession of it in the sense he was driving it, and the car valet at the hotel tried to stop him from taking it outside the fenced valet area. How is that any different than our situation where he's in the truck, has possession of it, and somebody wants to stop him from taking it outside the fenced area? I mean, they seem very analogous.
I believe the key fact that distinguishes them is in Wright, the thief had not moved the car anywhere yet before the valet got in front of it. And so this court determined that that was coinciding with the use of force, and that was sufficient.
So the court trumps the jury by deciding that the few feet here, instead of a foot and a half, it was 20 feet or however many, and we decide that.
I believe under this court's case law, it does dictate that there was not sufficient evidence because it was a legal definition of taking that the facts did not establish.
You know, if you have general dicta on a case that's entirely different, that doesn't deprive a jury of its duty and right to apply a proper instruction to these facts.
Your Honor, I think just looking at Petruk, for example, I mean, that would have been another instance where, I mean, this court did find that the jury, even though the jury came back guilty, they found that the evidence was not sufficient to meet the legal definition of taking, and we would argue the court should do the same in this case as well.
So what is your basis for distinguishing Wright, just to be clear? Is it the distance the vehicle traveled, or is it the amount of time that occurred, or is it both?
I believe it's that the force in that case coincided with the taking. So before the driver, the vehicle thief, moved the vehicle anywhere, the valet jumped in front of the car, and so the
force... Well, what was... does the record in Wright show the amount of time that elapsed between him getting into the perp getting into the car and the valet trying to stop it?
No, Your Honor. I believe that's why the court found that the verdict should be upheld, is because it was a split-second occurrence. There was no way to really...
And what does the record show about the timing here in this case?
Your Honor, I don't believe anyone testified to a specific time frame. However, looking at Exhibit 6C, which
well,
is...
Well, isn't that kind of a bit of a problem if you're arguing that the timing is the critical element here?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why Exhibit 6C does begin at 11:46 a.m. That's when... And in that exhibit's when the thief gets into the vehicle. Exhibit 6D, which documents DB getting in front of the vehicle to block it, that starts at 11:48. And so I think there's probably about a minute between when the thief gets in the vehicle and when he encounters DB, looking at those two exhibits.
But he hasn't moved the vehicle in that time?
No, he has, Your Honor. He's driven it from the back of the Bootsy. Yes, and
okay.
I believe DB himself testified that, you know, he was so far away he couldn't even see the thief get into the vehicle. So there is a distance between these two points as well as some time difference. And so our argument is just that by the time he encounters DB, he's the only one in that vehicle.
The same premises.
It is the same
you
premises.
You don't have a premises case supporting your argument.
No, Your Honor, but I do think...
I mean, that's it is what it is.
But I would point
that's
this court...
That's when it's fun, when there isn't any precedent.
I would point this court to, in Wright, again, all the court said is that the thief has to acquire possession of the vehicle for some period of time. And again, if you look at Holloway, it endorsed a very narrow time frame. It said the precise moment that the thief takes control of the vehicle, that's when we're supposed to be looking at. So I would argue, again, that it's not so much distance, it's that the time separating the use of force, because as this court, again, said in Petruk, if the thief is already in control of the vehicle, then they're, you know, and then uses force later, well, then the taking of the vehicle was not accomplished by the use of force, which is what the plain language of the statute requires. And I would also point to DB's own words. This is on volume one of the trial transcript, page 221, where he says, the thief had taken our truck and I was trying to stop him from getting away with it. So our position not only, I think, is grounded in the statutory text as well as the case law, but also just the normal usage of the word taking, as demonstrated by DB's own words there. So,
how about the brandishing factor? Does that have? Is there any case law on the timing there?
I think the court did encounter that issue in Long Pumpkin. It has to be during the carjacking. It has to be, and I think the court actually ended up reversing the 924 conviction in Long Pumpkin because they said the carjacking was accomplished before the brandishing of the firearm occurred. That's my recollection.
So the carjacker that doesn't brandish a gun until somebody two blocks away goes like this, gets away without the brandishing?
I believe so, Your Honor. If the carjacking was already accomplished at that point, then I don't believe they were using the firearm.
And is there a case that flat out says that?
I believe my recollection is the Long Pumpkin case did decide that, and they did reverse that 924J conviction. I can turn briefly to our second point, which has to do with the vehicle that was taken from TG at her house. We believe, again, that this falls outside the narrow scope of the carjacking statute. And I should be clear, we're not saying that the conduct taking in the light most favorable to the verdict isn't illegal in any sense. It probably violates a numerous state criminal statutes. It's just that it doesn't fall within this federal statute that is very narrow. Again, as far as counts 4 and 5 are concerned, there's no evidence that Mr. Clark ever demanded her vehicle from her. He didn't even ask for her keys or to look through her purse. He, going from her own testimony, said that he was not going to hurt her. He put her in the bathroom.
In the context, he was in a spree of carjacking, arguably, at this point. I mean, the jury, can't the jury look at more than just the moments around there to determine what was going on in this case? Or do you think it just comes down to those couple of minutes that encompass the interaction with the victim in this particular incident?
Your Honor, the government does raise that argument about 404B, essentially, and we would agree, I think, that the jury is allowed to look at all the evidence holistically. However, I think if you contrast, for example, the convictions having to do that we're not challenging at the Purina facility, I think they just show the differences. In that case, in the other carjacking, Mr. Clark is fleeing from Purina security, is in a real haste to get that vehicle, and so he actually does point a gun and say, give me your car, I'm going to shoot you, essentially. That's just not true here. There's no one pursuing him. He never actually asked for the vehicle. Under the government's own view of the evidence, Mr. Clark still had the truck from Bootsy that he could drive away with, and so we don't believe, again, that there was any intent by him that can be proven that he was going to kill or seriously physically harm her in order to get a vehicle that he never asked for.
Well, I assume this is clear error review on this issue.
Your Honor, we did raise a judgment of acquittal on this issue. The district court did give a reasoning for why he was denying it. So, I think it should be reviewed in the light most favorable to the verdict. But if not, we still think...
Okay, so then it, JMO, so it is clear error review of the jury verdict. Well, it's...
I think in the light most...
It's even more deferential than clear error review.
I think you could interpret it that way. I mean, I think we do have to take all the evidentiary inferences in favorable of the verdict. And only if no reasonable jury could find that a conviction occurred, then the court must affirm. But we don't think the government has met its burden in this case on either, any of those counts mentioned. And if it's okay with the court, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Finlan?
May it please the court, Ryan Finlan on behalf of the United States. I want to pick up where Your Honor left off as far as the standard of review goes. The standard of review is the same as in the district court, where all reasonable inferences are resolved in favor of the verdict. So the burden for the defendants is extraordinarily high.
On all the issues?
Well, yes, Your Honor, because these are... This
counts
is the most,
2 and 3, I guess it is.
2, 3, 4, and 5, Your Honor, because this is a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, which means that not only does the defendant have the burden of showing that there's no interpretation that a reasonable jury could reach that supports the elements of these offenses.
Well, isn't the definition of a taking, though, a legal issue?
The definition, that's correct. It is a legal issue. It's a de novo review as to the legal issues. And as to the definition of a taking, if you look through Wright, through Petruk, through Long Pumpkin, a taking is defined as the acquisition of a robber of possession, dominion, or control of the property for some period of time.
Let me stop you. If the district court defines the word taking in an instruction that is not objected to, can we simply go through and ignore the instruction and ignore the verdict and say, well, we wouldn't define it that way?
The legal issue would be reviewed de novo.
Well, wait a minute. There's been an unobjected to instruction. The purpose of instructions is to tell the jury what the law is, and then the jury decides based on that law.
And that's correct. And since there was no objection, that challenge would be waived.
Was there objection here to the instruction?
Not at all, by either side.
Then it's not de novo, is it?
No, it is a waived, you're correct. It is a waived argument, forfeited.
Waived or clear error, but
plain
error.
Yes, plain error. Thank you, Your Honor. But once you establish that definition, it's the acquisition of dominion, possession, or control, meaning that you set up a binary choice. You either have dominion, or you have possession, or you have control, or you do not. Where you have a defendant who is shy of those things, such that there's an obstacle that must be overcome by force, you have a carjacking, which is the case we have here. The district court set forth two alternatives for finding a carjacking. One is that the taking was ongoing, essentially that Mr. Clark had not secured dominion, possession, or control from the time he got into the car until he reached the fence and met Mr. Becker.
What are the facts preceding the time where he gets to the fence? I mean, was he driving around at that point?
He was driving.
He was driving the vehicle unencumbered by anyone else at that point, but the government's argument was he didn't have control of the vehicle at that point, or there was no taking, because he couldn't take it further than that point, out of the fenced area?
That's correct, and I think Wright's instructive on that point. I know Your Honor asked about the timing in Wright. Wright, the valet in Wright, suggested that it was up to 30 seconds that the defendant was in the vehicle, and that he was able to put the car in drive until the valet got in front of him. Very similar here, where, sure, Mr. Clark could operate that vehicle, but
he drove it.
He drove it. He could operate it.
It's different. It seems to me there's a difference. How important it is, I don't know, between putting it in gear and not being able to move and driving around in it and not being able to go as far as you want.
And I think there is an important difference. And I think the difference is that you could say that he has control to a certain extent, but I don't think you can say he has secured control. All carjackings have this element of dual control for a period of time, even Mr. Anand's carjacking. If you'll recall, Mr. Anand was in his car about ready to shut the door, such that he had control over his car, but the defendant blocked him from shutting the door. Now, the defendant has exercised some degree of control over that car.
Do you have a premises case?
We do. We have Wright.
That was taking from a person, or with a. By the time he's, it was either his. I can't remember if it was his car or if he had been a passenger.
And
he maybe wasn't pulled out of the driver's seat, but he was there by the car.
No, that's correct. So that's
that was a taking from a person.
Correct.
This is a taking from a premises, which is not carjacking. Until there's the presence of a person who says you can't do that.
And I think that gets to the point of what happens at the fence.
You have a case like this.
The cases that we cited would include Petruk, which, of course, this court found was
that
not.
That was taking from, well, it was taking from a home. The person being on his way. You still got it. It's still different. Here there was no, this was an unoccupied company car.
In the closest analogous case, such that it's a premise, would be Wright. Again, there's some distance between the time, temporally and spatially.
Auto dealer. I mean, auto dealerships have cars, loaners and everything else sitting in the lot with the keys in them.
And Your Honor, I would submit
I
that.
I imagine there hasn't been a, maybe the government's never found one of those or doesn't care about it.
I would submit that it would be difficult for the government to prove that that would be a carjacking if there is no person around. In fact, it'd be
a violation. So the statute says presence.
Correct. If there's no presence of another, if there's no one.
Well, the car dealer's got a lot of people are present who don't want to see the cars jacked.
There's also a.
So they run out or they block the gate or they do all kinds of things. And it's surprising to me that that's never been prosecuted under the carjacking statute, or none of you can find the cases.
To answer your point, Your Honor, no, I cannot find a case matching those facts. The closest ones I have are Wright and Long Pumpkin, and then the distinguishable case of Petruk.
So Wright is your closest case, but would you concede it's a closer call here than it was in Wright?
I would concede,
yes. You're closer to the edge of the statute here than Wright.
I'm closer to the edge of the statute, but there's also a second alternative that we found from Long Pumpkin, which is even if the court finds that the taking was complete once he started driving toward the fence, he's still boxed in. He's stuck. He's pinned, whatever term you want to use, and he cannot control or secure control until he points that gun at Mr. Becker, such that it's analogous to the second taking aspect of Long Pumpkin. So where if the court looks at this as one of those other alternatives, the second taking is more analogous to Long Pumpkin. The ongoing taking is more analogous to Wright.
So the difference between Petruk and Long Pumpkin on the second taking, what's the government's view? Because we rejected the second taking in Petruk, if I recall.
And you did. And
why is this more like Long Pumpkin?
Well, getting back to Petruk, Petruk had a situation where Mr. Petruk was driving down the open road, and he didn't have anyone in front of him. He had the open road. He could go as far as that road would take him. He had someone pursuing him that he decided to stop the car, decided to get out, decided to walk backwards, such that there was no obstacle.
Wait, you're talking about Petruk.
That's right.
The question was Long Pumpkin.
With Long Pumpkin, there's three alternatives. One, the court could have found that the carjacking was committed by Saul Crow before they ever got to the hotel. The other alternative was that the taking wasn't complete until, quote, full control of the van was secured by Mr. Long Pumpkin by dragging him out of the driver's seat. And then the third alternative from Long Pumpkin was that Saul Crow lost control such that Mr. Moore, our victim, is sitting there alone in the car, and then Long Pumpkin regained control by entering the car and assaulting our victim.
So which one of those works for you here? That's what I'm struggling with.
What works for us here is that you focus, if you look at the second taking, such that the victim had control moments before Long Pumpkin entered, that's more of the situation where we have at the moment of the fence, where there's a second taking at the moment of the fence because the defendant couldn't secure.
But there, Long Pumpkin was out of the vehicle, used force to extract the driver, and that was the taking, instantaneous at that point, right? And here, that's not what we have. I mean, the facts are, I understand the facts. Yeah. You don't have a case directly on point. These are strange, they're different cases. But that seems quite a bit different in this case. Because you have a car, you have the defendant here who was in control of the car driving around and was never removed from the vehicle.
And to answer your point, the facts are distinguishable. The principles are the same.
Okay.
Because, okay. Your Honor, as the court has set forth, that the possession, dominion, or control must be, as the terms used in Petruk, secured. In the other cases, they say acquired.
And all we have to do here is say the jury could have latched onto one of the, say, two theories that you're putting forth here.
Not only that, is the jury could have done that, but the court would have to even go further for the defendant to prevail and say no reasonable jury could have found either or of these two alternatives. Turning to the second carjacking of TG's Jeep, there's no meaningful distinction between TG's Jeep carjacking and the carjacking we saw in Castile. Both
what?
In,
I didn't.
In Castile, Your Honor. It's the 2011 case. Or, yes, 2011 case. Both involved burglaries into occupied homes. There was an imbalance of power, whereas in Castile you had multiple defendants armed with firearms. Here you had a defendant with a firearm. There's testimony that TG is only 5'2". The defendant is 6 feet. There's brandishing, and there's physical restraint of the victim. This was a presence case where the keys to TG's Jeep were taken from her presence because she was overpowered such that she couldn't retain possession of her Jeep but for the fear of violence and intimidation. I know Your Honor asked my opposing counsel whether or not the court can look at facts throughout the day, and the jury could. Of course they could. This was a 3.5-hour ordeal where the defendant attempted to take 5 cars. The first was a tan truck, then the Busey truck, then he broke into Mr. Paniello's home, and then he broke into TG's home, and then he carjacked Mr. Anand at Purina.
Do the brandishing counts live or die with the carjacking counts here? I mean, is it the same analysis?
They do. Okay. They rise and fall with the underlying subordinate carjacking counts. So.
Well, you could have carjacking without brandishing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I don't think that's being argued. I couldn't tell from the brief. I think it's an interesting question. That's why I asked about the timing. Do they have to be coincidental or simultaneous?
Yes.
Nothing being argued here is logical to me.
Well, there is an additional element of the 924C charge, which is not only do you have to find the underlying count, but you also have to find that firearm furthered the carjackings. Here it's axiomatic. The firearm was the force used in the Busey carjacking. The firearm was the force used.
Even if the carjacking was completed?
If the carjacking was completed, the firearm is furthering that carjacking by preventing.
So if it was 10 miles away and somebody got in his way and he pointed the gun out the window?
It aren't the facts here, but I could see a reasonable jury coming back with a verdict saying that firearm furthered my escape.
Have you got a case like that?
Not on point, because it's not part of the facts here. The firearms were used simultaneously.
Well, it was a big part of a truck. I mean, he snuck off with the car from the home when nobody was looking, and when the owner caught up with him, then the gun came out, or the force.
It was, but Your Honor, in Petruck, it was a hammer used, so there was no 924C at issue in Petruck. Because there is ample evidence supporting the jury's verdict, the United States requests that this court affirm the jury verdict as well as the judgment as to all counts. Thank you.
Going back to Judge Loken's question, I was just looking back at Petruck. That didn't involve a gun, because that would be the Petruck situation. I was just looking back here. Apparently, Petruck swung a hammer, or used a hammer as a weapon. But if he had used a gun, that would have been Judge Loken's question.
Yeah.
And your position is that if he had used a gun, that would have furthered the carjacking, even though the carjacking was complete at the time of the assault?
My apologies. I didn't understand the question. Changing the facts of Petruck, I assume that because there was no carjacking, you don't have the element of a 924C had he used a firearm, because that is one of the elements that he did commit the carjacking.
Well, to that extent, my question was hypothetical, but what's the answer to it?
I believe a reasonable jury could find that using a firearm down the road would secure a getaway such that it furthers the carjacking. And that's probably a case for another day. Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
May it please the court. I do want to just take up the issue about the fact that at the time Mr. Clark encountered DB at the Bootsy facility, he was in full control of the vehicle because he was the one who had driven it around the facility. And the district court actually even posited, it's in the volume for the trial transcript at page 313, that Mr. Clark, his only option wasn't to point a gun at DB. He could have driven the car through the fence if he wanted to. Again, that shows that because he's in full control of the vehicle. The Long Pumpkin case just is not analogous here, because there, this court recognized there was a modicum of uncertainty because the first taking, the victim was actually still in the driver's seat, and it was the defendant who was holding a gun to their head. And so, we're not sure if a jury could find that that was a taking or not. But once they got to the hotel, everyone got out of the vehicle except for the victim. The victim was left in the driver's seat. And so I think it's clear a jury could find that that's the defendant's losing possession of that vehicle or ceding possession. That didn't occur here. Mr. Clark never got out of the vehicle, and no one else ever got into the vehicle. Again, Exhibit 6C clearly documents a nonviolent taking. He hops the fence, gets into the vehicle, and begins to drive it away without anyone ever trying to stop him from doing it or him using any level of force. It's, again, not until he gets to the front of the facility, which takes about 40 seconds to a minute, that he encounters DB and brandishes the firearm. So I just don't believe Long Pumpkin is analogous here, and I don't believe the Wright case is either, because in Petruk, again, this court held that you do not have to reach a safe haven for a taking to be complete. A taking is complete once you acquire initial control over the vehicle, which is what I believe Mr. Clark did here when he got in the car and began to use it.
And what's the case for that proposition that a taking occurs when you get initial control?
Petruk uses that language, Your Honor, and it clarifies what the court held in Wright. For those reasons, Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire. We'd ask that the court reverse counts 2 through 5. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been thoroughly and well briefed and argued, and we'll take it under advisement.